Once a month, we visit with our partners at the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, SULA, for a segment we call Underground History. Chelsea Rose and Mark Tveskov of SULA bring in people and stories about archaeology and the intricate and fascinating process of literally unearthing the past. This week, our discussion is less about digging in the ground than about the difficulty in digging up information about African Americans in early Oregon. There were not many people of color due to exclusion laws, but there were some, and they are commemorated in an online exhibit of the Oregon State Archives for this Black History Month. The exhibit is called Black in Oregon, 1840 to 1870. Chelsea Rose from SULA is with us this month without Mark Tveskov. Hi, Chelsea.
Hi. Good to be here.
Good to have you. And from the Oregon State Archives, we have Lane Sawyer, the manager of reference services. Hi, Lane.
Hi there.
And Teresa Ray is with us as well. She's a reference archivist. Hi, Teresa.
Hello.
So, Lane, let's start with you. I mean, it's enough of a surprise to even realize there was much to put into an exhibit of being black in Oregon from 1840 to 1870, given that upon statehood in 1859, people were not allowed to be in Oregon if they had dark skin, slave or free. So, I mean, how much of a dig was this in the first place just to find stuff in the archives?
It was pretty challenging. Oregon does hold the distinction of having the only constitution that had both the exclusion clause against free blacks, but also against slavery. So starting from that point of view, it's hard to ferret out some of that information. But prior to statehood, the provisional and territorial government sort of went back and forth on excluding or allowing African-American settlement. And as a result of that, there were some people that did make that journey out or came by ship in some case. And so you can find little tantalizing bits of information about some of these early people. And what becomes more challenging is that you'll find an intriguing story and then the trail kind of goes dry or is incomplete. And so that in some cases has led us to, you know, include a story but not have a real complete picture of what that person's life might have been.
So the trail goes cold in a sense where you're aware of somebody living in a certain place by a certain name and then something changes.
Yeah. A good example from your part of the state, which it is the Matthews family that came out from Missouri. And some folks in your listening audience may be familiar with that family name, but also Ty Burrell, who was on the Lewis Gates program, Finding Your Roots, is descended from that family. And so there was a little bit more to kind of tag onto as far as finding the names. They were listed in the census for Jackson County in 1854. And they were a very large family, families of 12 and more children in some cases. So there were a lot of different threads to follow in that particular family. And so it was one of the ones that you felt a little bit more assured that you were making a bigger picture. Unfortunately, they oftentimes were, because they were mixed race to begin with, they were listed in a lot of the later records as white, and so sometimes it was like, is this the same person, or...
Oh, wow, just even tracking one individual person, because they'd be listed differently at different times, sure. Yeah. The mention of Ty Burrell, it took me a second to get it. He is the actor from Modern Family, who graduated from Southern Oregon University and is from the region originally, yeah.
Right.
And so he was on Henry Louis Gates' program about checking out your roots?
Yes, and they included this storyline with the matriarch of this large family that had come out to Jackson County.
Now, you mentioned how Oregon seemed to oscillate back and forth in certain laws. And one of the more effective things I found from looking through the archive, and again, it's called Black in Oregon, 1840 to 1870. It's fully online at the Oregon State Archives. We're linked to it. Was when you lay things out in a timeline and you get to see just the various changes, it almost seems... I don't want to say it's whimsical, but I mean, it does seem like things changed rather fast as you look at what the attitudes in early Oregon were about people of color, Lane.
Yeah, there were certainly people who came to Oregon from some of the border states and southern states who held fairly strong views, and some of those immigrants did bring slaves with them. And then you had other people who came from the New England states who either felt fairly strongly against slavery. And so between those two kind of communities, there oftentimes was a conflict as far as their attitudes towards allowing blacks into the region. And one, at least two of the stories that we feature include petitions to allow black families to remain in the territory and not be subject to the exclusionary laws that would have forced them to leave.
I want to bring Chelsea Rose in here because one of the things that rather surprised me as I looked through the exhibit at the Oregon State Archives was the idea that Jacksonville was the heart of pro-slavery country in Oregon at that time. You were probably aware of this from your many digs and works with Jacksonville with the Chinese community.
Yeah, so Jacksonville in the very early days, well, for a minute, right after the gold rush hit down here, it was one of the larger urban centers in the state. But they also had a lot of, you know, there was a lot of interesting political views leading up to the Civil War here that happened in our part of the country. One of the things that's interesting is, you know, like you said, there's a lot of, you can see different people are kind of coming at it from both sides. A lot of the laws that came in to early Oregon during the territory definitely impacted African-Americans and mixed-race folks, but also they're the same ones that targeted the Chinese, Native Hawaiian, Native American. So a lot of these laws are really targeting a whole big group of minorities. But the African-Americans were different in that they were actually excluded. Some of the exclusion laws targeting the Chinese are more immigration-related, so they control who comes in and out of the United States. But the state itself, you know, the exclusion laws targeting blacks in Oregon, you know, that's something that was a whole other level of extreme.
And you've mentioned the lash law in previous visits, Chelsea. What was that?
Well, that, you know, I learned more about that from this exhibit. That was pretty incredible, that if whoever was here, if they didn't leave, they had a punishment of, I think it was like, and maybe Lane and Teresa jump in, but like 37 lashes every 6 months if they were still here.
It was something along those lines. I think maybe that number is 30, but it was, but to my knowledge, never actually implemented. But it was
on
the books.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. Because one of the things that's so interesting about this is because on the books there are these exclusion laws, but we know folks were here. So how, you know, were they just, they were on the books but never implemented? Were they the people that were here were maybe protected by communities? I think one of the exciting things about this exhibit and also some of the work the Oregon Black Pioneers has been doing is it really raises the profile of this part of Oregon history and really highlights how much we have to learn. I come across African-American settlers in a lot of different research aspects, but we haven't really taken a deep dive into this part of our regional history, and really we need to, or somebody needs to, because there's definitely a lot of stories that should be told.
The exhibit at the Oregon State Archives is called Black in Oregon, 1840 to 1870. This is our Underground History segment. You just heard from Chelsea Rose at the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, our regular partner on this project. We also have from the Oregon State Archives Lane Sawyer, the Manager of Reference Services, and Teresa Ray, the Reference Archivist. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Teresa, I just wonder what kind of shape things are in the archives. I mean, I know, you know, generally you want to keep it in good stuff, but you know, over the years, has it been delivered to you in forms that are difficult to work with? Or, I mean, how are things back in the archives themselves?
They're pretty well kept. I think being the state archives, we were very fortunate in the building that we were in since, I believe, it was
1991.
Yeah, so the building we're in, is it was actually built to house archives. Previously, we were in kind of a warehouse. So, like, we're very fortunate that we do have climate-controlled areas. Basically, our whole all of our holdings are climate-controlled. So we have a variety of different things. We have a vault with photographs in it and, you know, audio materials and negatives. And then we also have areas with, like, paper materials as well.
How do things get to state archives, though? The kinds of materials you're trying to work with here in this period from 1840 to 1870, where would these records have resided originally, and how did they get to the archives?
That would be a question I'm going to defer to Lane, because okay. she's been at the state archives a little bit longer than I have.
So the records that are at the archives are public records, so some level of government. And in the course of preparing this exhibit, some of the ones that we used most extensively would have been those that were created by counties, in part because county-level government has a more direct connection to individuals than state in many cases. But because of the time period we were looking at, we also relied heavily on the provisional and territorial government records that we have, which the earliest record in our holding is from 1837, and we feature a couple of the petitions for Morris Thomas and the Abner brothers that were from that period of time in that collection of materials.
Chelsea was asking a question along these lines a moment ago about the fact that black people in early Oregon, I mean, had no rights. I mean, they were not supposed to be here under the original constitution of the state of Oregon as it became a state in 1859. I guess the question is, what do the archives say, if anything? Are they mute on the point of whether, you know, why people stayed here in a case where they really didn't have any recourse if they were victims of discrimination or anything else, because they weren't supposed to be here?
Yeah. The idea that we would know sort of those motivations would probably be more likely to be found in personal letters or writings like diaries. So the public records don't speak to it so much, but one of the cases that's highlighted, and Teresa did more of the research on that, so I'll maybe let her talk about it, but was the Holmes family that were brought out as slaves and ended up in Polk County. And after having been here a short while, they were freed, but they ended up fighting for their offspring. So I'll let Teresa talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Let's hear that one, Teresa.
Yeah. So it's kind of interesting, and I think this is to a certain extent kind of a trend in kind of doing some of the research, you know, whether or not people were, you know, brought here, you know, by owners with the, I guess, promise that if you, you know, help settle the land, that we will, that I will release you. A lot of the people that were coming here, I know specifically from Missouri, I'm not sure about some of the other kind of border or southern states, that a lot of the African Americans that were coming to Oregon were forbidden to be literate. So you run into some interesting issues with people coming here and, you know, being, freed, like the Holmes family. They came, they were slaves of Nathaniel Ford, and they settled in Polk County. Now, initially there were six kids. When they initially were going to come out, three of them got sold, so they stayed in Missouri. And from our research, I don't think they were ever reunited. But then the other three children came to Oregon, and then I think the Robin and Polly Holmes had a couple of other kids in Oregon. So the family was told they would be released after they helped settle the land. And only the parents, Robin and Polly, and the youngest child were. And so this one is one of the very few cases that's actually pretty well documented in court records. Basically what happened is it is unknown how Robin ended up getting legal counsel, but he ended up with legal counsel and basically took Nathaniel Ford to court to sue for his other three children to get them back. And he, by an amazing way, ended up winning that court case. And it's also really interesting, too, because, you know, you're looking at, you know, a window into the racial dynamics of the time, you know, the precarious status of, you know, African-Americans in the early pioneer days, you know, and also the perseverance of Robin and his family in asserting their rights. And, you know, it was also interesting in that time period, too, you know, you did have white settlers that were willing to help. You know, whether, you know, assuming he couldn't read or write, you know, basically somebody transcribing what he was saying and what he was, you know, promised. And, you know, the back and forth between what Ford was saying and what the Holmes family was saying. So it was really, really fascinating. And also it also kind of brings into other questions of other laws from back in Missouri, like the fugitive slave law. There was some sort of writings or testimony about how Ford was really frustrated and was trying to get them sent back so he didn't have to deal with the issue anymore.
But at least,
yeah, it was a really, really fascinating story. And like I said, you know, it's interesting too, because a lot of these records, you don't really have a lot of you know, personal writings.
Yeah, as Lane said, no diaries or anything. Yeah, there's no narrative with it, right? We're talking.
So, you know, go ahead.
This is Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about the Oregon State Archives exhibit, Black in Oregon, 1840 to 1870. You can see the whole thing online. Teresa Ray is a reference archivist at the Oregon State Archives. Lane Sawyer, manager of reference services. And we have Chelsea Rose with us, as always, from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology. Let's go to a call from Don and Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange.
Oh, good morning. This is fascinating as we look back and get to know these people. One of the interesting things, we live in a house that was built by one of the Applegates about 100 years ago, and I think it might be interesting to mention the split in the family. There were abolitionists and pro-slavery people in that family, and I think that's one of the things that in the history of Oregon that's kind of interesting. But I just have to mention that my father worked with a black architect, one of the first important black architects in the country, when he was, he got to know him at the University of Pennsylvania, and later the two of them designed Duke University together. My father was the site planner. Since Mr. Abel couldn't travel or get a room or get a meal in Durham.
Sure.
But he was the designer of the buildings of the chapel and more importantly, the gym where they play basketball. My father was the site planner, and they worked together on it. And I think people working together like that, I think that needs to be documented, as well as the outrageous things that we know about. And my father was colorblind, by the way.
Oh, really? Literally colorblind, yeah.
He was, but he was a pretty good painter in spite of it. Mr. Abel was quite a guy. He's Julian Abel, well worth studying.
Okay, thanks.
Like Dion Thank here in Eugene.
All right. Thank you so much for sharing the story, Don. Appreciate that. Another call here from Tony in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange and Underground History.
Good morning.
Hi.
I wonder if your guests know much about one George W. Bush, who settled, it's a famous name, I know. He settled in the Oregon Territories or the Washington Territories. He came in 1855. Apparently, and according to the Oregon Blue Book, he was the richest man to attempt to settle in Oregon, which is an interesting thing in that era. I think that blacks were making money back then.
So he was African American, you're saying?
Oh yes, yes. Sorry, I thought that was the subject matter of this program. And he eventually settled north of the Willamette River. So he. He chose to avoid Oregon. But why on earth would Oregonians throw out the man who apparently was as rich as he?
Well, that's a great question for the time. Thanks for that, Tony. Appreciate it. Lane, did that name cross your eyeballs as you went through this process?
Yes, actually, I believe we have his story as part of the exhibit. And I believe he originally was in Clackamas County. Teresa, you, I think, worked on his profile a little bit more than I did.
Yeah, he was actually born in Pennsylvania, and he was actually ended up being one of the earliest permanent settlers of the Puget Sound area. But he came out with his family along with four other white families. And if I remember properly, he was adopted by a white family.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so he ended up coming out in the Oregon Trail from Missouri in 1844. But he actually knew the western regions because he, at one point, was a trapper. So that made him a huge asset to the wagon party. But then also, before, when they were coming out, you know, like I said, he made his money trapping and doing some other things as well. I think he might have done a little bit of ranching, too, mm-hmm. if memory serves. But, you know, 1844, really the discriminatory laws hadn't been, you know, on the books, or they were very recent.
Right.
So they were unknown to them by the time they got there. And so since, you know, that had been acted, the Oregon Territory enacted legislation preventing African Americans from settling or owning land, that's why they ended up deciding to go north. And so not only Bush and the four white families, but yeah, they, all of them decided, you know, like, hey, this is, well, who knows what they said, but, you know, in theory, it's just like, okay, this person is helping, they're part of our group, this, you know, isn't fair, so we're going to go a little bit farther up north, because with the northern Oregon Territory, you're kind of a little bit farther away from the reaches of the, you know,
oh, sure,
law enforcement of
exactly.
the time period.
Long arm of the law.
But yeah, so they ended up settling the land, farming the land, you know, building like Barry's first grist mill and sawmill, and then they also ended up helping travelers settling in Tacoma and Seattle. They kind of set up this kind of like a crossroads, you know, to help, you know, feed people or
so
help them for a little
influence.
Bit on their journey north.
Okay, we need to close it off here. The exhibit is called Black in Oregon, 1840 to 1870, at the Oregon State Archives, where Teresa Ray is a reference archivist, Lane Sawyer, manager of reference services, and Chelsea Rose, of course, from SULA for another Underground History. Thank you all.